Ashley, as a young blood at Shiat, New York, you were so poor that you once ate pizza off the sidewalk. Fact or fiction? Something that almost no one knows about you is that on weekends, you work as a rave DJ.
This was in the early 2000s.
That is surprising. You once called your husband John in a panic, thinking you would be fired after finding out a vodka tonic you ordered in can was $26.
This week on the Bagley Talks to an Important Person podcast, Bagley talks to Ashley Davis Marshall. Now, you are probably asking yourself, is Ashley Davis Marshall an important person? Is she some sort of scientist? What kind of advertising awards has she won? Where has she worked? Is that enough awards to warrant important person status? Should I listen to this podcast while I walk my pet iguana tonight? And the answers to all these questions are as follows. Yes, no. Cannes Lions, One Show Pencils, D&AD Awards, Webbies, and Andy. Creative at Chiat, creative director at Whedon and Kennedy, and ECD at the Martin Agency. Definitely yes. And yes, definitely.
Somewhere along the way, I learned that helping and being nice are not one and the same. In order to help people, you have to sometimes.
How do you sell great work to clients?
Nothing kills an idea like just blank stares, because then the blank stares last long enough. They interpret them as like, oh, nobody in here likes this work. So you want to have.
So open the brain of your heart and get all your questions answered by former Whedon, plus Kennedy CCO and Martin ECD Ashley Davis Marshall. Any questions?
Well, it's your lucky day, you headphone-wearing bastard, because Jason Bagley's podcast is here. Oh, yeah. He's gonna interview the most important person, so shut your mouth and f***ing open your ears. Yes, it's Jason's podcast, the best you can get anywhere. And if you pay a attention, you'll get your mind blown. But I should probably tone it down, cause Jason Bagley wouldn't want me to swear. Yes, it's Jason Bagley's podcast, baby. You better get out your notebook and your pen. He'll interview a mother important person.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the podcast. There's two reasons I'm excited. One is by the end of this episode, you are all going to love Ashley Davis Marshall as much as I do. She is hilarious. She is so smart. She is so talented. And I had a blast working with her for many years. The second thing you're going to learn is that no matter how accomplished you think somebody is, even somebody as amazing as Ashley Davis Marshall, what you're gonna see is that we all battle the same demons of low self-confidence at times and imposter syndrome. Even the people that you think are the most confident and the most successful and have some sort of magical powers, underneath it all, they're feeling probably the same emotions that you're feeling. So I hope that gives you some encouragement and some validation. And one big disclaimer, we could not get my normal streaming application to work, so Ashley and I switched over to Zoom, and apparently my touch-up appearance setting was set to 14 million because I look like a full-on CG animated character. Unfortunately, my forehead is just as big in the CG animated version of myself, and that's about all I have to say about that. Let's get on with the interview with Ashley Davis Marshall. Ashley, welcome to Bagley Talks to an Important Person. It's a tremendous honor to have you. How does it feel? How do you feel? Do you feel
overwhelmed, speechless?
Have you thought about this for many years, hoping and wishing that you might be an important person?
I would say, how long have you been doing this? That's how long I've been hoping and wishing. At least 2 years.
At least the amount of time.
At least 2 years. If not longer.
You're one of the people that I'm always very grateful that I got into advertising and got to be friends with, because I'm always talking about how I feel like advertising has allowed me to hang out with and become really good friends with the most interesting, awesome, amazing people. And you're one of those people.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I feel the same way about you. You are a very awesome person. And I don't know that, I don't think we would have been able to meet had it not been for advertising. I feel like that's probably a definite thing. We probably wouldn't have met.
Yeah. I feel bad.
I guess
maybe we were destined
to be friends no matter what. Let's screw this podcast and start just doing a different one. Would you or would you not have met?
Advertising people that may or may not have met is the name of the podcast. Okay.
Catchy.
We're going to start today's podcast with a fact or fiction game.
That sounds delightful.
I'm going to read something off. And you're going to tell the audience if this is fact or fiction.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Ashley, as a young blood at Shiat, New York, you were so poor that you once ate pizza off the sidewalk.
That is fact.
That is factually true.
Yes, it is true.
Fact. How far you have come. How far you have come.
I don't know. You don't know how much I like pizza.
Okay. Fact or fiction. One summer, you were a ranch hand on George W. Bush's Texas ranch. And you once castrated a large bull with your bare hands.
Not with my bare hands. No, I never did that. That is fiction. All of that is fiction.
Fiction. That is surprising. I thought I had pegged that one for fact, given your Texas upbringing. Okay, fact or fiction. You moved in with three other recent grads and lived in a one-room apartment. In a one-room apartment.
Not one bedroom.
One bedroom. In Bushwick, Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And this was in the early 2000s before, this is fact, before Roberta's, which is that restaurant that's like super trendy. It's been there for like 20 years. It was before that was even there.
You know,
it was a total shithole.
What's funny is I, for two semesters when I was in college, I shared a room. One room with two other guys. So there were three of us sleeping in this room, and we had like twin beds, little tiny beds, and there was nothing else in the room. And it was just, you walked in, it was just like linoleum floor and these three beds. And we called that apartment the NADGE, which was short for the orphanage. Because it very much seemed like we were living in an orphanage, but we were we were 20-year-old people. Yes. Okay, fact or fiction. Something that almost no one knows about you is that on weekends you work as a rave DJ. You DJ at raves. Fact or fiction?
I really wish I could say that was fact. I think it would make me a lot cooler if that were true, but unfortunately, it is fiction.
Fiction, everybody.
Surprise.
Fiction. Okay, fact or fiction. You once called your husband John in a panic, thinking you would be fired after finding out a vodka tonic you ordered in can was $26.
That is true. It was had a fancier name than vodka tonic, but yes, I think it was like $35. So I don't know if it's completely true.
And you're like, but they're going to fire me over this.
They're going to fire me. I was really stressed out about that. It's true.
Okay. All right. Last one. Fact or fiction. You once rode an elevator with Betty White at BBDO.
That is fact. That was pretty cool. And David Lou Bars. Two legends.
Did you talk to her?
One elevator.
I did.
I told her that I was like, you know, normally I tell celebrities something really stupid. Like I normally would tell her something like, you are a golden girl. And she would be like, yes, tell me something I don't know. But I think I was actually pretty cool. I was just like, I'm pretty honored to be in an elevator with you, Betty White. That's pretty cool. And she was super gracious.
She seemed like she was pretty cool.
Yeah, she's a lovely lady.
By all accounts. All right, well, we've gotten to know you a little bit better, and we're very excited about that, Ashley.
That was fun.
We should do that every week.
Just you and me hop on, and one of us creates a bunch of factor fiction.
That's good.
I don't know why this made me think of this fun game, but were you on Craig Allen's party bus in Portland for one of his birthdays? And there was
which one?
Yeah, there is always a Craig Allen party bus, but it was one of his birthdays. It was a party bus. I joined late. I met up with you guys at some intersection, jumped on the bus, and when I jumped on, everyone, I think Craig said this, and everyone went along with it, that they had just finished playing the game. You know, say something really embarrassing about one of your coworkers on the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And they, in fact, had not been playing that game. That no one had done that.
I was not on this one. I don't believe.
Anyway, I'm not going to say it. I'm going to cut this story off.
I'm going to cut myself off right there.
Right there. Because it was embarrassing, and I'm not going to have it permanently recorded on this interview, but I did share some things.
I'm going to tell you something that most ad agencies won't. I'm Jason Bagley, former chief creative officer of Wieden & Kennedy Portland, and the provocative questions that have helped my teams and I make iconic campaigns for Old Spice, Nike, KFC, Samsung, and others. Are the types of provocative questions that we're usually discouraged from asking, which is why I created these 63 provocative questions that I call the Mega Machine questions. This is the exact list of questions that I use to get hired at Wieden & Kennedy and that my teams and I use to make award-winning work for 20 consecutive years. And I'm giving it away for free. This is without question the most powerful concepting tool that I have, and it has led to more great work than any other tool I'm aware of. So if you would like a free copy of the 63 questions that many of the best creatives in the world use to make iconic work, hit the link on or around this video and go nuts.
All right, Ashley, let's start. Let's get started. Let's get into the meat and potatoes of this discussion. I've often said, and when I say often, at least three times throughout my lifetime, that I've never seen a world-class creative who didn't have at least one world-class mentor.
Yes.
I've just never seen an exception to that rule. And as one of the world-class creatives out there in our industry, Ashley, that's you.
Oh, God.
I'd be curious to hear who were some of your mentors and how did they help you achieve full Ashley Davis Marshall status? And in full transparency, this is just a setup for you to mention my name in this list of mentors.
Of course. Well, first and foremost, you were one of those mentors, but I have had a long list of pretty awesome mentors. I've had Greg Hahn. I've worked for him. I've worked for Jerry Graff. I've worked for Scott and Ian. You, I've worked with and for Craig Allen, Dan Wieden. I mean, like, just the list goes on and on of these amazing people that I've gotten the chance to work for. But probably one of the greatest ones was, there's two that really stand out. One is Jerry Graff. I fell into like a lucky scenario with him. I started as a young blood with Craig. And Craig and I were both like super, super junior, but super, super ambitious, but didn't know anything, you know, knew nothing about how to make great work.
Eating pizzas off the ground at this time.
For example. And we went to work for John Hunt, a lovely human. He was great, an awesome creative director, but we didn't know him from Adam either. But he ends up going somewhere or going to a higher up position. And then somebody comes in and it's Jerry Graff. And we were babies and we didn't know who Jerry was. We were just like, cool, we're getting a creative director. That's awesome. And he came in and I know we pretty immediately won Skittles. Like it was just given to us. We had some Mars stuff. And I remember like Craig and I were a little bit like, Skittles, huh? Okay. But, you know, it didn't have great advertising prior to that. So it was just, you know, we've been doing kind of a series of like just kind of advertising until then. And then Jerry came in and we found out we won Skittles. It was just given to us. And then we started working on Skittles for Jerry. And I think that's when I discovered that humor actually came a little easier to me than I realized. I thought that I was like this serious, like poetic kind of writer. But I'm terrible at that stuff. And I thought I was terrible at comedy, but actually I think it was my stupidity and ignorance and all of that that actually made me a little bit better at that. But anyway, started working for Jerry, started watching like his work and seeing like all of his Snickers stuff and being like, huh, you can make a living out of that? That's crazy. And so Craig and I never looked back until I decided to separate from Craig and stupidly move to Texas. But that's a whole other story. But anyway, so, Jerry's been around for a very long time. He would push me and Craig into like, you know, keep going. It was kind of a joke, like Scott and Ian too. They would just always do this, give us this feedback, which was keep going. We would all laugh and come out of the check-in and be like, did you get a KG? Yeah, I got a KG, which was keep going. We were all like, didn't know what that meant, but we just had to keep working and keep pushing ourselves. And I think it was that sort of made us realize that like, you just have to keep going, like until it's funny. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you stumble on it the first time or the 87th time, just don't give up and you will get there. Even if you don't know where you're going, you know?
Yeah.
It was brutal, but we did a lot of fun stuff under his tutelage.
And just to give people an idea of how far you kept going, it was, I've never worked for Jerry or Scott or Ian, but they're kind of legendary for really pushing creatives very, very hard and having just incredibly high standards themselves. And therefore you have to really deliver something phenomenal before it's going to meet their approval. And I think Eric Kallman and Craig would say like they went back and figured it out that for every Skittles or Starburst or Snickers spot that they made, they had to write, it was either 150 scripts or 250 scripts. Let's just say 150 scripts. Like they had to actually present 150 scripts to get one approved. And I point that out just to say it's really hard. It's really hard to do. Yeah. It's not an accident when you see some of that fantastic work or any fantastic work that gets out into the world. You have to go beyond what's even reasonable. You have to get into the realm of just unreasonable amounts of work and effort to get to greatness. I think that's just a true principle in life. But
absolutely. I can tell one story about when Craig and I were hate concepting, if you want to hear that story.
Yeah, let's hear it.
It is a tangent off of the last thing, but we were working on Starburst and there was a campaign that was going to the clients and everybody at Shiat loved it. It was, I can't even remember what the campaign was, but Craig and I were like pissed because Jerry specifically asked us to go write some more because we couldn't go to the client with just one campaign. But Craig and I were both like, well, so we're going to write the like crappy campaign that you're going to not sell. So we went off and like kind of bitched and moaned about it for at least 20 minutes. We were just like, this is stupid. I hate this. And just getting really mad about it. And so I think out of spite, I just started like rattling off the dumbest ideas I could possibly think of just because I'm like, if you want to take an idea to the clients, well, by all means, take this. And then we just started like building off of it. And then I think like, I don't know, 2/3 of the way through it, we're like, wait a minute, this is kind of funny. it was Ernie the Klepto. And I don't know if you're familiar with that one, but it's still to this day is one of my favorite spots that I've had the pleasure of making. And I think it was because we were just so stupid about it. We were just like, we were literally out of spite trying to write something that they couldn't sell. And then Jerry fell in love with it. He was like, I guess if we sell this, it'll be okay. And he did. Yeah,
that's a fantastic spot. I've found for myself that to create the optimal environment for creatives, you have to have two things. You have to give them a tremendous amount of autonomy and freedom, but then you also have to have incredibly high standards and very high expectations of them. And sometimes those things almost seem like they contradict each other or that they're at odds with each other, because the nice CD, a lot of us fall into the trap of we want to be nice. We want to be like, I want my creatives to like me. I don't want to push them too hard. I want to give them a lot of freedom.
Yeah.
And the mistake that CDs make, in my opinion, is they don't pair that with extremely high expectations. So how do you try to provide both that freedom, but the extremely high expectation that goes with it?
Yeah. Well, couple of ways. One, I definitely, when I'm looking at the schedule for like how this is going to roll out, I try to be very specific at looking at like, when's my first check-in and when does it go to the client, so that there's enough time for them to react and respond to the feedback I might have on the work, and that they don't feel like they're rushed to slap it together and get it all, you know, and then being mad about it. That would be bad. So I definitely try to make sure I bake in enough time for creatives to respond to feedback, whether it's from me or their immediate CD or the partner or whatever. So that's like number one crucial thing, so that you can give them the autonomy to get to where they want to get to. Because you just can't expect people to just like nail it like that, nor should you, because then back to our original point, they're not getting to that greatness, you know, that great place. And then I think the other thing is just, you know, like operate with the assumption that your teams, your creatives, they want to be amazing. And then if they do, then they'll be responding to that feedback. And if you're giving good, clear feedback on like why you don't like something or why you think it's not quite good enough or where you've seen it before or why it's, you know, any number of things not quite clicking or hitting where you want it to, they'll want to hear that, because, you know, if they want to be great, then they don't want to put the effort in to make something they've seen that everyone's seen before, or, you know, isn't quite as funny or feels like a joke that's been told before. All of those things are not things that people really aspire to. And if they seem like they do, well, then maybe it's just not the right fit, you know, like that's fine. Our priorities aren't the same. That's fine. We don't have to work together at that point.
Yeah. Well, on that note, can you give an example of, just for creative directors out there who are, you know, going to face this issue, when you had a creative, and you can sort of fictionalize this, if you want to protect the name, if you're afraid someone might recognize the story, but you have a creative that is consistently not performing. They're just not getting it there. They're not, for whatever reason, they're not performing at the level that you need them to perform as creative director that you are, and the type of work that you're trying to do. How have you dealt with that? Like specifically, what type of things do you say to them, or how do you approach that situation?
Well, I did learn something from you, that I think was pretty great, a pretty great tool. And I used it with Ruth and me. I think you probably remember this, but we were working on some, you know, digital idea or some sort for Old Spice. And like, we showed you some work and it was all good, but it wasn't great. It was just kind of like, yeah, we could go make this, but like, is it worth it? Is it worth the effort to make this? That kind of feeling, which, you know, as a creative is crappy feedback to hear, but at the same time, if you want it to be great, you know, like, okay, well, it's gotta be great. So you worked with, the planners at the time, and you had them put like just a ton of post-its on the wall of, you know, like all kinds of disparate things, like whether it was like technology that was emerging, or it was a social media platform that was emerging, or it was something that was hitting in culture, or it was some fact about the product itself. All of these hundreds of post-it notes were surrounding us in a room. And so we just started like connecting the pieces, like almost like, you know, Homeland or something, you know, we're just like drawing all these lines and stuff. And then I think we ended up with like, we ended up showing you like 20 ideas or something. And I think you ended up loving like 10 of them. And then a couple of them to this day, we didn't make them, which is a bummer. But to this day, I still look at those ideas and I'm like, those were really killer. So I think that that's a great tactic. And I'm not just kissing your ass. I think that that's an amazing tactic to just take unknown things and bring them together and just kind of like shake it up and see what happens. You can also do it with AI. You don't have to use post-it notes. And this is something I get people to do sometimes. I'm just like, just start typing in weird mix of things, see what comes back on ChatGPT. Yeah. And maybe you'll be delighted by that. And maybe it'll inspire you. So yeah, it's just, you know, shaking it up. I think chemistry is important for all of it, whether it's like the thoughts that you're bringing in to create the ideas, or the partners that you're working with, or the clients that you're working on. So just mixing those things up, because I think you really can't tell if somebody is like, you know, for lack of putting it less bluntly, if somebody's not good and not talented, or they're just not getting the right mix of things. And yeah, if you can mix it up enough times that they eventually start, like something unlocks, then you know that, I guess, you're doing your job. And if you just keep mixing it up enough times and then it doesn't unlock, then I think, again, you know, like this probably isn't a right fit.
Yeah. One of the things we're pretty bad at in this industry as creative directors, and most creative directors are bad at this because their creative directors were bad at this and their creative directors were bad at it, and is we're not very good at teaching practical skills. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of the, just keep going. Yeah. But like, we should, as creative directors, I think it's part of the job of actually teach them how, give them some tech. Don't just say, just go back in your office and look at a blank wall and try to come up with ideas. Like, teach them, like tell them, teach them the techniques that have worked for you, and give them some specific things to try. And like you said, you might find that they're incredibly talented. I totally remember exactly that instance where you and Ruth came back with just unbelievable ideas, and lots of them. And I even remember some of the ideas to this day. we should be teaching creatives and giving them skills that they don't currently have. All right. I think this is a challenge that great creative people that were really accomplished, amazing creatives, when they become creative directors, is that they know how to make the work great. So how do you know, as one of those creatives, when you become a CD, how do you know when to step in and when to jump in and make the work better versus, you know, obviously the goal is to try to get the creatives to do it themselves. But how do you balance that of like, okay, the work's still not there. I think I know how to get it there, but how do you make those decisions?
I mean, I think this is the work of being a creative director. Like, you know, being a creative, the work is coming up with the ideas and making the decks and everything. And I think as a creative director, the work is to pull those, pull better ideas out of people who didn't know it was there. So I think it's important to just, you know, put in the time and actually concept with your creatives. Like, bounce ideas with them, toss out, you know, lines that are funny, say the things, take the time to sit with them and go over their scripts together, You know, and if you're in this day and age, we have to do a lot of work remotely over, you know, in through decks and stuff. So if you are putting in notes in a deck, pull references to, you know, shows or movies that you've seen that, you know, kind of, you know, start to pluck at the tone that you're looking for or the visual that you want. I think just being very thorough with what you think an idea could be or how it could start to manifest. I think that's super helpful, but really it's just the time to actually say the things, pull up the references, do the things that, you know, these creatives need to see to understand where your standards are and kind of what you're envisioning. That's the important part. And that's the part that takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
It's the hard work. Because it's kind of like, you want to say like, oh, I'll just let them figure it out. That's probably the nice thing to do. But then they'll go and they'll do it. And then they're just frustrated because they're not bringing you back what you envisioned. So, you know, everyone's frustrated then. So I think just making sure you sit with people and really articulate what it is you're trying to say. I'm always saying like, am I making sense to you right now? Is this clicking? Are you understanding? Just to make sure we're all on the same page.
Yeah.
I think it's super important.
So kind of work alongside them in a way of don't just.
Yeah. Go figure it out.
Yeah. They'll figure it out. Like I think we usually, you let them go like the first round with maybe not a ton of direction, but then you start like shaping it, being like, hey, here's what, what about this? And inspire them to how big it can be and how amazing it can be, even before you have a specific idea, if they're coming in with small thinking.
Totally. I was looking at work the other day and there was something for a completely separate brand, completely different idea. And the insight was different, but there was something about the tone that I was like, I showed them this other piece of work in a completely different category. And was like, I love how they're talking about, and I'll just say like, it was a Nike spot. I love how they're talking about running with a passion in this piece of work. Now take the product that you're working on and think about how you might be passionate about using this and how you also might have insecurities or, you know, whatever that kind of, you could start to draw some parallels. And how does that make you think about this product? So hopefully that kind of stuff also gets people thinking about things differently, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's just staying inspired yourself is really important to transfer that energy over. I think if you're just going through the motions and not feeling like you're inspired to do the work, then I think it's really hard.
I think a big trap on that note that it's very easy to fall into when you become a creative leader is you stop exposing yourself to creative input and creative inspiration. And like, as a creative, I feel like it's very natural that you're just like always shoving stuff into your brain and like scouring the internet and going to movies and like searching for inspiration. And then you become a creative leader and you get really busy and you have all these other responsibilities and you're not in the trenches as much. You don't naturally have as much time to do that. Mm-hmm. And so you just kind of, if you're not careful, you stop doing it. And then your ability to help your creatives gets drastically reduced because you can't share things with them. You can't pull like really cool reference that's, you know, not totally outdated and no longer
relevant. Yeah.
So I think it's important as creative leaders that we kind of build that into our habits and schedules to make sure we're still getting, it also keeps you, like you said, as a creative leader, it's important to be inspired and to be energized and excited. And if you stop consuming stuff that excites you, you're going to kind of, the job is going to kind of lose its
like atrophies.
Yeah.
Your like ability to generate new ideas. Yeah. It's tough. It's tough to keep up with that though, for sure. It's like, there are so many hours in the day and
yeah,
it is very hard, but that's what TikTok's for. Just little bite-sized things.
Love TikTok. Okay. Ashley, let's talk about leadership.
Let's do it.
The definition of a leader, I've heard this said, and I'm going to go ahead and just take full credit for it, pretend like I said it. But the definition of a leader is someone who has followers. Mm. Like, you can have a title, you can have a leadership title, but not actually be a leader because nobody wants to follow you. Mm-hmm. Or not have any title at all and actually be a leader because everyone wants to follow you. And the way that a group identifies, it's very primal. The way a group identifies who they view as the leader is the person that's willing to sacrifice the most for the group, for the benefit. Mm-hmm. And I think people get that. A lot of people get that wrong about leadership. They think it's like some prestigious position where you don't have to do as much, where you're like the top dog. Everyone else has to work for you. Mm-hmm. That's not a leader who's going to have many followers with that. Yeah. And in reality, the best leaders are working harder than anybody. They're doing more grunt work and kind of miserable, unglamorous work than anybody. But what are some of the ways that you, as a creative leader, sacrifice, or what are the ways? I won't make you say it about you because that'll sound like bragging. But what are ways that a creative leader can sacrifice for the group, for their teams, so that people want to follow them, so they're an inspiring leader?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually really hard, but like celebrate others. You know, I think there's like because you've been a creative for so long, and you've been, you know, looking for those accolades and the attention and you know, people recognizing your ideas. I mean, it's just, it feeds us as creatives. So you've been looking for that for so long, and not that you haven't gotten it, but like once you become a leader, the recognition starts to come in faster because you have more people who are working under you, and you're making an impact on more people, and you've got more at bats, I guess, because everybody's doing all of this work versus just you and your partner. So I think it's really important to keep track of the victories, small or large, you know, whatever they may be, of the people who are working for you and with you, and acknowledging them to others. Because as a leader, you're the one who's in the room to present the ideas. You're the one who's talking to people at a higher level who are saying, that was a great thing that got made. Making sure that you remember to give credit to the people who came up with the idea in the first place, the people who produced it, the people who, you know, in business affairs who somehow managed to get that idea sold. It's just trying to remember all of those people, because it takes a lot of people to make a great idea happen. I mean, and I certainly don't succeed every single time, but I try really hard to make that happen. And when you don't do it, acknowledge it and say, like, I kind of sucked in that moment and it didn't give you the credit you deserve. So I think it's a shift, you know, to go from like searching for that recognition to almost not needing that recognition anymore and making sure that you're giving it to everyone else. I think that's the thing.
Yeah, that's really important. Kind of going back to your Jerry Graff shout out, I think one of the most unselfish, caring things that a creative leader can do is push their creatives really hard. Is push their creatives to do things that they may not want to do and that they may not think they're capable of doing. And it can be quite uncomfortable as the creative leader that's doing that. But if you really, it is, I think it's an act of love, because if you really care about that person, you will risk the short-term hatred that they might have for you. And it's like a good parent. Like,
yeah,
good,
yeah,
parents will do, they're willing to be hated by their kids for a short period in order to really help their kids in the long run and help their kids become the people that the parent knows they're going to be much happier and more fulfilled by becoming this person. I think as creative leaders, we have to do that for creatives. And I think there's too many creative directors out there that are more concerned with being liked and being, you know, really nice. And in the long run, of course, we want to be empathetic and caring and all those things. But I really think one of the best things you can do for people is to really push them and help them see that they're capable of way more than they even thought possible. And it's going to be uncomfortable. And the person might not like it very much, but they will thank you later.
100%. Yeah, that's so true. And I think for me, like, I learned along the way that I do actually really like helping people, and that, like, that's part of my DNA, I think. You know, I think it just comes from, like, teachers for parents, and, you know, that's just who I am. I just want to help other people. And somewhere along the way, I learned that helping and being nice are not one and the same. In order to help people, you have to sometimes say the hard thing. You say it in a nice way, but, like, you have to say the hard thing. I'm afraid this isn't going to be good enough. I'm afraid this isn't going to be where you want it to be to get what you want it to get. And I think having that experience helps, right? Like, you've been there before, and a lot of times tell stories because I like to talk a lot, but I will tell stories about, like, my failures and my setbacks and kind of, like, where I failed to see something and why I wish I had done it differently, just to help motivate as well. Like, we've all been there. This isn't new. Me telling someone that their work isn't good enough is not new. I've heard that as well.
Yeah.
I have been told I'm, you know, I'm not cutting it. That happens to all of us at some point.
For sure. I mean, it's a quality of every, I don't think you'll find, like, a Hall of Fame coach anywhere that wasn't known for really pushing their players, you know, beyond what they thought they could do. And
hey, everybody, if you're interested in making better work and would like to know exactly how my teams and I at Wieden & Kennedy, and now at Alto, have been making award-winning work for the past 20 years on brands like Nike, Old Spice, KFC, and others, I have what has been called the industry's premier creative coaching and mentorship program. I didn't call it that, but other people did, and then I just said it into this microphone just now. I've taken almost 700 creatives through my program so far, and they have an average 5-star rating.
Is that 5 out of 10? If that's 5 out of 10, that's a really bad rating. Oh, it's 5 out of 5. It's 5 out of 5, everybody. That's an A+.
These programs are not for everyone, but if you qualify, I will personally teach you exactly, step by step, how to rapidly start doing the best work of your life. I have sessions starting in 1 week, and nearly every session so far has sold out. So if you are interested in grabbing one of the final remaining spots, you can apply at the link below. I hope to see you there.
So let's see, what else do I want to ask, Ashley? Have you ever had the experience of a creative leader doing something that really eroded your confidence in them, or just made you kind of disrespect them, without mentioning any names? I'm just trying to see if there's people could learn from.
I definitely have, and I think it's probably off, you know, similar to, or at least created the sort of, like, ideas that I was just sharing with you. That's what formed those thoughts of, like, not taking credit for other people's work, and not, you know, not acknowledging people's contributions to creative. That certainly happened to me in days, and now I've got, like, this, like, over concern for making sure everybody gets credit for their work.
Yeah.
Like, whether it's, like, in a pitch deck where you move ideas around and somebody else's work gets moved into someone else's group, I obsess over making sure that that one idea never gets lost into this other group of work. because it's important to that person and the team who came up with that idea.
Yeah.
And it's just not fair.
Yeah. That's a great example of like, that's a very quick way to lose followers is like, if they view you as trying to take all the glory.
Yeah. You're over. You're done.
You have lost all loyalty from those creatives at that point.
Yeah. They'll go work for someone else for sure.
Yeah. Okay. What do you have any tips and tricks that you would share? As a creative director, you've sold a lot of amazing work to clients. This is a big, mysterious question that
I
can tell you every creative is dying to know. And every creative director is dying to know. How do you sell great work to clients? What would you say are some of the keys that have worked for you?
Yeah, I think for me, and everybody's different, but for me, remaining calm, being casual through the idea, those are really important. Talking to people without presenting to them, I think is really important when you're trying to get people on board with an interesting, bizarre idea. I think people can sense when you're like turning on something false. So I genuinely will always try to make sure that I'm just not being somebody that I'm not in order to sell an idea. Cause I think that people can see right through that. And if they can trust you and think that you are always the same person, they will trust you if you try to sell them or show them this crazy idea, just as much as you say, I don't think that's the right idea. So I think building trust and not putting up false pretenses is really important. I think pre-selling ideas and work is great. Not only does it kind of prime the pump, but it also shows certain clients like, hey, I have a little respect and I see you as a team player. Can I show you this idea and get your reaction? Because I really value you. I think that is an important part. And then you can get their reaction and they can help give you like some insight or information on like how their coworkers might respond to the work, et cetera. And then you also have the sort of added bonus of when you show the work to everybody on the client side, it's not brand new to everyone, because there's nothing kills an idea like just blank stares. Because then the blank stares last long enough. And then everyone in the room starts to believe that those blanks, they interpret them as like, oh, nobody in here likes this work, right?
Well, therefore,
I don't like the work because no one else is comfortable with it. Yeah. So you want to have some people bought into the idea early so that when you're presenting, you're not being hit with that just immediate wall of no reaction. So I think, you know, just don't be too precious with the idea and wait for the big reveal. I think that can kind of be a detriment sometimes too.
And how do you like developing that client relationship to start developing that relationship of trust and pre-selling? If you're talking to a creative director somewhere who's listening to this podcast and they're like, well, that makes total sense to me. I would like to develop more of a relationship with the client, but I don't know how to do that. The account team and the strategy team kind of, they seem like they're the ones that interact with the client. I basically talk to the client when it's time to present creative ideas. Do you have any advice to them of how they could proactively start to develop that relationship with the client?
Yeah. First, I would say you don't need anybody's permission. Like it's another part, it's a human, like you don't need their permission to be able to like reach out to that person. We all have connections with people internally and externally, and whether or not you build that connection before or after the client relationship started, I don't think that matters. I think you can still connect with a person regardless of what your position is and what their position is. You can also...
And I'll just add to that. In almost every case, the client will be thrilled that you,
exactly,
as the creative leader, that you want to have a relationship with them, because they probably assume you don't.
Yeah. And
so they're going to just, that should make it easier to realize, oh, they're probably going to love this. They're going to love that. I want to have a one-on-one relationship with them.
Yeah. And they're going to love that you can tell them, I saw some great ideas today. I cannot wait to show them to you tomorrow. Like, they're going to love, and it's going to help them sleep at night when they hear that you're excited about the work. Or if you see an idea and you say like, oh man, I really love this idea, and I want to get in front of them as soon as possible, because if we wait till tomorrow, we're toast. Then you can just send it over to them and be like, hey, this is what you're going to see tomorrow, but we need buy-in early. And you can just have that shared relationship where it's like, okay, we're in this together, and we both believe in this idea and we want to make it happen. So let's get moving on it. And I think, you know, just the way to get that is just first and foremost, just like reach out to the client. If you have to reach out on LinkedIn or whatever, you can be like, hey, it was a really great meeting today. Would love to get your phone number so I can text you some things, or can you give me your email address so I can shoot some things out over to you? Just stuff like that. You know, like you can track them down. I mean, don't, what's the word I'm looking for? Follow someone around. What's
stalk
that word?
Stalk.
Yeah, that's the word. Don't stalk them. That would probably not go over well.
Well, but usually, yeah, you can just get their contact from the account team.
Yes. Unless they're being weird about it for some reason.
Unless they're being very weird, yeah.
Sometimes people can like want to protect relationships.
Yeah, and I think, to be clear, we are not saying do the account team's job for them or make their job more difficult by, you know, sometimes you need to loop in your account team partner of like,
yes,
hey, here's what, just so you know, here's what I'm thinking. I want to have a conversation with the client. Are there any watch outs? And so they can be like, oh, actually don't talk about that. Or they'll think, yes, you might also bring up this. So as long as you're looping them in and make it clear to them, you are not trying to take over their job.
Yeah.
This is
nor do you want to. You've got a job.
No. Yeah.
But yeah, I do think the relationship's super helpful. If you can develop that relationship, it's much easier to sell work.
Yeah.
But 100% don't go behind your account person's back and do it. That could be really problematic.
So when you get a brief, or like sometimes it's just sort of the initial thought that you're having a conversation with the strategist is sharing, here's what I think the brief should be, or here's the rough draft of the brief, and it's just not, you don't think it's inspiring, you don't think there's really much of an insight there, what do you do as a creative leader to help with that, so that the creatives don't end up getting briefed with a brief that really has just a bunch of facts and figures, but no real insight and no inspiration?
I mean, I don't see a lot of strategists bringing briefs like that to me. I will say that. So I think I'm pretty fortunate, but I do love strategy quite a bit. And I think most strategists know that I really love that part of the process. So when they bring a strategy to me, I will immediately start asking questions like, do we have this? Do you have any data that substantiates this? This is really interesting. Oh, I love this part. So I immediately just start talking about the pieces that stand out, and then immediately try to start executing. Like, you just have to get really fast at like, how would I execute off of this insight? And if it's not there, I just be honest and say like, this is really interesting what you put together, but I can't add anything to it. It's not generating additional thoughts for me. This is kind of the end of the line on this thought for me. So I don't love this one, but usually somebody will bring a couple of strategies, a couple of briefs, you know. It's not just one brief and you're done.
When there's nothing there and you can't build on it, I like to tell the strategist, this is a dead strategy. It's a corpse of a strategy. They like that.
they like that a lot.
They like it when I say that.
This is dumb. I'm sure they love it. I probably wouldn't say that, but maybe you can get away with that.
I am joking. Ashley knows I'm joking, everybody.
I know you're joking. Yeah. So I think, you know, people, our job is to also train strategists. I think I'll just say that, like, I don't think you can just write a brief first rattle out of the bag and be like, this is how it's done. Like, go forth and make ads out of it. Like, we have to, you have to sit with strategists too and hash it out and think about like, what would make a more, what's a more interesting, compelling way to say that, or unearth the kind of interesting things that are, that, that they do say, because a lot of times it will be buried. Like, the really cool part of the brief will be buried in some like consideration point. It's like, here's your brief right here. This is the cool part.
Yeah. I think the takeaway, what I'm getting from what you're saying, is just as a creative director, get involved in the strategy. Don't just like get the briefing done. Well, this is it. This is what we got. There's nothing.
Yeah.
Like, take ownership of it. You know, don't get outside your lane. It's the strategist's job, but it's your job to help the strategist understand if it's working or not, or if this is going to be inspiring or not. And of course, the strategist wants that. Every good strategist, they want to provide something that's going to be really inspiring to the creative. So they usually welcome your involvement.
Definitely.
I should have asked you this beforehand to think about this, but I'm increasingly curious if any creative directors have different go-to phrases when they're giving feedback. Because I feel like I probably just use the same. I have this hunting feeling that there are creative directors out there that have way better and clearer ways of saying something than I do, but I'll never learn what those phrases are because I don't work for them.
But I think I probably say you're just scratching the surface a lot. Like, you're just scratching the surface of an idea that's really cool, but let's keep going on that. Keep going is probably something I say a lot. But with a little more context.
A little more context, yeah.
I'm sure if you ask people that I give feedback to, there's probably some really annoying things that I say that I'm unaware of.
They would be better. I think asking them what you say, they probably remember it more than you do.
Yeah. It's either cringy or it's like, yeah. I mean, I could talk about like when you gave feedback, your best feedback was your laugh. Like that was the thing that everybody wanted, was to get you to laugh.
That's what I wanted too. What do you do? So we have a lot of setbacks as creatives in this industry. There's a lot of rejection, a lot of ideas, great ideas getting killed. You know, strategies changing, clients, budgets getting reduced. A lot of things happen that can be pretty devastating for creatives and everybody else involved. Do you have any advice for what a creative director can do or say to their teams when there's just been like a massive disappointing, you know, the creative team has worked really hard and they've gotten the work up to your standard and it's awesome, and maybe it was about to go into production or whatever the situation is, just a really disappointing, like disheartening thing happens. Do you have any thoughts on what a creative leader can do to help creatives, you know, in those times to kind of get through that and to remain inspired and all that stuff?
Those moments are really shitty. And I think acknowledging that it truly does suck is probably the best thing you can do in those moments. Acknowledge how awesome the work was and how hard you wanted to fight for it. I think those are really important things to make sure that you convey. I think sometimes there's an opportunity to show work that didn't get bought or didn't get made or almost got made. I think trying to find those moments to share it, because it doesn't make it any less of a great idea. And then you know, just giving people a little space to sort of grieve it, because it is what we put our lives into in this job. So giving, you know, don't throw them right back at it. I think if you don't feel like they've got it in them at that moment, give them a little time to mourn, I guess. And then, shake it up again, you know, like put them on something different. Like,
yeah,
find something, you know. I think you always know when a team or a creative has sort of expired on a battle or something, you know, like they've really been fighting this fight for too long and they need a break and we need to mix it up. And then just put a different team on it and put them on something else that's good and move on. I think it's the only thing you can do in those times. But
probably the worst thing you could do is just go and be like, hey guys, it's okay, man. I mean, just, you got to pick yourself up and maybe they'll come back and buy that. Like, I think what you said in that moment, like that might be, you might have that conversation a week later, but in that moment, I think just empathy and just being, letting them see that you are really disappointed also, that you're devastated. It doesn't feel good when you're devastated and somebody else is acting like they're not devastated.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's fine to just like feel it with them, like you said, initially, and then, you know, later come back and try to get them inspired and give them another opportunity, and always letting them know, like, in your eyes, they won.
Yeah.
They may not have succeeded it with getting work produced, but they have succeeded as far as you are concerned.
Yeah.
They got to great work, and that's really their job, and they succeeded at that job.
And it's very important. Those are very important words to share. People need to hear that. They need to feel like they're doing a good job, and they're not going to get fired any minute because of something out of their control.
Yeah. Do you have any advice on just how to conduct a great creative review? Like, as a CD, what are some things that CDs can do to make it a really good and effective experience for creatives?
I think I would never like just jump into the work right away. Like, just crack some jokes, make some, just get it, loosen everybody up a little bit. I think that's really important, because I think as creative directors, we sometimes forget that creatives come in to present their ideas and they're actually really nervous about presenting, because as creative directors, we're just there to listen, and that's not that hard. There's no pressure there. So I think trying to like release that pressure just a little bit is important. And then I think that the check-ins usually go better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just working with the teams and helping them craft the idea in the check-in, I think is great.
Yeah. That's good advice. I also think, one of the things that I try to do, and I tell other creative directors, just sit there and take in the ideas and just enjoy hearing creative ideas and respond like a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And don't turn into a robot that is calculating the brief and the client, and you're like, you're breaking apart their presentation. And so you can't respond with genuine emotion because you're analyzing everything too much. First, just respond.
Yeah. And
if it's funny, then laugh. Even if it's funny, but totally off brief and totally wrong, if it's funny, laugh. you'll make that creative team's whole week, that they made the creative director like genuinely belly laugh. And then you can tell them, like, why it's wrong and why it's not going to work, but it was really funny. And then after you've responded as a human being with emotion, then you can get into like, all right, now let's think about, is this going to work?
How can we possibly sell this idea?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can start breaking it down and engage your more logical part mm-hmm. of your brain. But I think there's too many creative directors that are just, they're in the logical analysis the whole time. And so they can't, it's not very fun for the creatives. Not getting that genuine reaction.
Yeah, it's pretty bad, actually. It's actually like, I hate being in those kinds of check-ins. It's been a while, but they're really, really awful. When the creative director gets too analytical right off the bat. Yeah, sorry, I just had a flashback.
No, it's terrible. And you can be a really hard, I think you can, maybe some of my creatives would disagree with this, but I think you can be a really demanding, very difficult to please creative director with super high standards that really pushes your teams and still have creative check-ins be an experience that creatives look forward to.
Yeah.
Because you can still inspire them and laugh together and make them feel like they are, like, first of all, they should know, man, this creative director really wants me to succeed. They are invested in me and they react in a totally genuine way to the work, and they laugh or they say something's amazing or inspiring or whatever. Everything that they presented could die and they can still walk out of that check-in actually feeling kind of good about mm-hmm. themselves. And that's I think what you want to achieve.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes I wonder, like, I laugh so much in check-ins that I sometimes will be like, should I stop laughing so much? Because am I sending the message that I'm just like super easy to please? But I just like laughing. And I think you're right. Like, I think you can enjoy a check-in without actually even achieving the goal of the job. Like, we can still, I mean, we're just people who are sitting around talking. Like, that's a really enjoyable thing that we get to do.
Yeah.
And so if that's our job, and I don't know, am I making any sense?
Yeah. Like, you should enjoy the process. And even if that meeting doesn't result in like a great idea, it can still be a fun process. It could still be an interesting process. And that's, I think, what you want it to be for the creatives. You want them to look forward to. It's fine if they're a little bit nervous, because they have a lot to live up to or whatever, but I think you just want it to be something they look forward to and they feel good and inspired, as much
yeah.
as possible. It's fine. It's also fine if there's times where they leave your office pissed off and and not very happy with the feedback that you gave, because that's also at times inevitable. But I think it you should really try to make it a good experience for them.
Yeah, I agree. It's just part of life.
So when, I don't, probably everybody knows this, or they probably haven't thought about this, but when Craig and I, after running Old Spice for many years, decided it was time for us to move on and hand the reins over to somebody else, we, along with Fitzloff, we decided the heirs to the throne should be Matt and Ashley. What did that feel like for you guys, and what were some of the pressures or emotions that you felt as first of all, being a new creative director, which has its own mm-hmm. you know, anxieties and whatnot. But also taking over a brand like Old Spice had to be a little intimidating.
Extremely intimidating. So I was promoted when I was on maternity leave with my second kid, and Fitzlaff called me and said, "Hey, I was wondering if you could do lunch this Friday." And I was still on maternity leave, and I was like, "Oh God, what's happening?" Like, the things that went through my head of what was happening, not one of them was what was actually happening. Like, not a single one of them. And I remember getting to lunch, and you and Craig were there, and I showed up with Fitzloff and Susan, I think, maybe. Susan was there. I can't remember if I showed up with Susan. And then Matt Sorrell was there, and he and I made eye contact. And I remember looking at him, because I've known Matt for a million years as well. And I looked at him, and I could tell right away, like, he doesn't know what's happening either. And then I thought he didn't even know. Neither one of us knew we were sitting down to lunch together. And then Matt and I sat down next to each other, and I was like, "What's going on?" And Matt was like, I don't know. And then I believe Fitzlaff ordered champagne or something. And I was like, okay. And I was bracing myself to get like a really hard account. Like, because that was one of the scenarios that went through my mind, was like, I'm going to get a really, really hard. And I'm not saying Old Spice wasn't hard, but it was hard in its own way. It was also very fun, but like just one of those, like, you know, slog accounts. And I think you and Craig spoke first, and you were like, "Yeah, we're gonna go. I think it's time for us to move on, and we want to hand the account over to you guys." And I think you probably could have picked my like face off the floor. I was like, "What, me?" And it made sense for Matt, because Matt had just produced a couple of really great Old Spice campaigns, but I'd been working on a bunch of other stuff at Wyden, and I don't think I had even made anything for Old Spice yet. So I was very confused. But then Mark Fitzloff told me that he said some really nice things and said that he thought that I had it in me, I guess. And so I gave it a go, but I remember I was so nervous about it, because like, obviously this is, so many people have said this on your podcast, but like, nobody wants to be the one to destroy an iconic brand, an iconic campaign. And so I just remember like starting the job and not knowing what the hell I was doing, and sitting in a room, and I was just like trying to like just give feedback, like wide-eyed, like I don't know, I think we should. And then I think I said something like, I don't think we should put the logo on that, or we should think about whether or not we want to put the logo on that or something. And then everybody turned around and looked at me and waited for me to make this decision. And I was like realizing, oh my God, this is on me to make this decision. This, I can't just like flippantly pass out my opinion. Now I have to like start making decisions. And that was terrifying. And giving creative direction to people that were like outstanding creatives who had made more Old Spice work than I had was terrifying. And it took me a little while to get to where I felt comfortable with it. And I think probably making something from start to finish with a team was probably the thing that got me there. Like, I was like, okay, I can do this. I can give feedback on this stuff. I can help make the work better. I can help teams. And that, and then, you know, we did it for a couple of years, but it was absolutely terrifying. I really had probably the most imposter syndrome I've ever had in my entire life was when I got that job.
You're welcome. we knew you guys would do an amazing job, and you did. Some awesome work. It was really fun to see what you and Matt and the teams did that was different from, like, who knows if Craig and I would have approved the same work, or if it would have, it certainly would have come out different. We might not have even approved it. Who knows? But like,
who knows? Yeah.
It was exactly, to me, it was exactly why we felt like it was time, because we thought it was, we'd done so much work, and our fear was that maybe we're kind of coming at this in the same way that we've already done for years and years and years. And it's time for somebody to come with a fresh new approach, which you guys absolutely did. And I felt like there was a bunch of work that you did that I was just so refreshing for me to see, because I wasn't involved with it. And it was like something unexpected and just fantastic. Something that you said, the challenge that I felt when I first became a creative director, and I know there are some people who don't suffer as much from this. Like, I want to say people like Eric Baldwin, who are just so decisive, and so their opinion about things is so on the surface, and they can say it and articulate it very rapidly, at least how they feel about it. And that was probably the biggest challenge for me when I became a creative director, is the sheer speed at which I was expected to make so many decisions and to quickly have an opinion formed and to be able to articulate that opinion and that direction. And it was just like, that muscle was not properly developed for me when I took that role, which I think is very normal. But the sheer number of decisions that you have to make as a creative director, especially if you're running a brand that's producing a lot of work, is very overwhelming. It can be very overwhelming, and it's a muscle that you have to develop, and being able to quickly know how you feel, assess the work, and be able to translate that into feedback all very rapid, like in real time, was super overwhelming for me.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I do feel like it's definitely a skill that I had, or a muscle that I've kind of developed at this point. But in the beginning, it certainly was like impossible, because there's so many factors, but I think the biggest one for me was probably like self-doubt in the early days. Like I needed the outside source to tell me an idea was good to fully believe it was good. And so it took me a little while, a pretty long while, to be able to say like, oh, if I like it, then it's good. You know, like my opinion is just as valid as anyone else's. And at this point, I'm in the driver's seat, so I can make this decision because that's my job. But it took me a long time to be able to accept that. It's pretty terrifying when you need that outside validation in the beginning, and then suddenly you're in charge.
You can't do it. Like, you cannot make decisions based on what everyone else might like, or what you think everyone else might think. There's just too many variables in that. It's impossible, in my opinion. It's impossible it's impossible to be an effective decision maker if you're like operating like that. It's just too much. Like, you have to almost just put the blinders on and get into this sort of zen feeling of like, okay, what do I think?
Yeah.
What is my opinion? And that is just as valuable. Like you said, I got to trust that opinion, because that's the only way you can rapidly make decisions.
Yeah, it really is. Just trust yourself. I think it is a level of selfishness that I think some of us just aren't as accustomed to be able to like value our own opinion above others. That's a really hard thing to kind of learn how to do if you're not used to it. But you can always say like, well, someone valued my opinion. They put me here. So here I am.
Also, you have to do that. Like, it doesn't matter if your opinion is in fact not as valuable.
Yeah, it doesn't. Like, it is right now. Yeah.
You have to, you have no choice but to make decisions. That's what you're being paid to do. And the only way to do it is to lean into what you believe and to like lean into your voice and your instinct. And it doesn't matter if it's the best, instinct in the world, it's the only one you got, and you have to lean into it and hope that you can, you know, develop it and get better over time and continue to elevate your taste and all those things, which all that will happen if you work at it. Well, Ashley, this has been a delight. I'm so happy that we finally got to connect. This selfishly, I love doing this podcast because it gives me an excuse to get on with some of my favorite people and just hang out for a couple hours, which is something we never have time to do.
So true. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. It's been fun catching up with you.
I think people are going to get a lot of value out of what you said. So thank you very much. And we got to hang out somehow, plan some reunion, and all get together.
I will be in Portland next week if you're going to be there.
I will definitely not be there, but
just by chance.
Yeah.
All right. Well, sometime.
All right.
Don't be a stranger. All right.
Thank you so much, Ashley.
I will.
Let's pretend like we're saying goodbye here officially, and then we'll stay on for 10 more seconds and say a real goodbye. Ashley, thank you so much for being on the podcast. This has been so awesome.
It's been a real pleasure.
What an honor. Goodbye, Ashley.
Likewise.